Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the June 2011 edition of the Chemistry World Podcast. With me this month are Eleanor Richards, Patrick Walter and Philip Broadwith, and we're discussing, amongst other things, DNA that's been fashioned into a nanoscale flask, what you can do with a nano diamond aerogel, the mind literally boggles, and a revolution in cigarette filter technology. Plus, the risks you take with biosimilars. These are copycat molecules of major drugs.
There are many, many types of erythropoietin that are being used illegally and perhaps being sold to patients illegally, which are not efficacious. So they have the wrong sugars attached to the erythropoietin, and so they're cleared in 3 minutes from the patient, where they should stay within the patient for 3 hours.
We'll hear shortly how the regulators are tackling that one. Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
And up first, fish and chips, anyone? Eleanor.
Well, it's actually fish in chips, and this is about growing embryos in microfluidic systems. So Michael Richardson from Leiden University in the Netherlands and his team have raised zebrafish embryos in microfluidic chips.
Exciting. I've heard of them raising zebrafish embryos in little dishes, because normally scientists have them in little multi-well dishes, and these fish are attractive for research because they're transparent and you can see straight through them with a microscope in order to study them. Yeah. Makes the research very easy. So what's wrong with doing it that way?
The thing is in these little wells, you keep having to change the buffer solution in each individual well, which means that it damages and causes stress to the zebrafish embryos.
So how have they done it? What have they done that's different?
So the team made the device from 3 layers of borosilicate glass, which contains an array of temperature-controlled wells connected by channels. Now, each well houses a single zebrafish embryo, and the buffer solution can flow through these wells, so you don't need to keep replacing it.
So the idea is basically you have this pre-made research gadget. It's got the fish in, the buffer flows over it, and you can just subject them to whatever experiments and interventions you want to. Any evidence that it's actually better, or that it works at least as well as the traditional way of doing it?
They looked at the growth and development of the embryos, and after a 5-day culture, they saw that actually there was no significant increase in abnormalities. The body length was just a little bit shorter. They did demonstrate the potential for application in drug screening assays by releasing ethanol into the wells to induce embryonic abnormalities.
And when will they be introducing this? Is this available for researchers to use now?
Well, it's not available now. It's the chip is promising for drug discovery in which small quantities of compounds are available, or if the compound's very expensive, but it's not ready yet.
Well, thanks, Eleanor. That was very interesting. Stick to fish and chips for me, I think, though, but it's certainly an interesting step forward. Now, talking of things that are very small, Phil, this is very exciting. DNA origami producing a tiny flask. Now, I remember going back about 5 years or so when scientists actually made a little smiley acid house face out of DNA. Now they're actually going to the point where you can make physical objects out of it.
Yes, Chris. If you think of DNA as a long strand, it's actually not very stiff. It's quite flexible, and you can make all sorts of shapes out of it. And people have been making ever more complicated shapes by taking a long strand of DNA and then several short strands that they use to kind of staple and link it together. And mostly those have been constrained to kind of flat things, or combining several flat sheets together to make, say, a box. But what Hao Yan and his team at Arizona State University have done is to take a slightly different approach and use DNA like a worm coil pot that you might have made out of clay as a child.
I did indeed make one of those when I was at school. How do they do it, though?
OK, so if we think of DNA as like a worm pot, what you're trying to do is take a long strand of DNA and coil it and attach it to itself as it coils. You can make each coil of DNA slightly bigger than the last one and fix it on, so you get like a spherical flask. It looks like a classical round bottom flask from a chemistry lab.
Is that a picture of it you've got there? Because that looks a bit like a sort of snake charmer's pot with a long neck. It's almost a volumetric flask, isn't it, to take a chemical analogy?
Yes, Chris, that's exactly what it looks like. And we did a quick calculation in the Chemistry World office and worked out, using the dimensions that the team gave us, that it has a volume of something like 24,000 cubic nanometers, which would be enough to hold about 800,000 molecules of water.
Apart from being elegant, what do they say you could use the technique they've developed to do this for?
So because we can make much more complicated shapes, you can start thinking about making shapes that will trap specific things in them, so templates for growing nanocrystals or capsules for drug delivery or that kind of thing, but really completely tailor-made. And because it's DNA, it's also functional, so you have the opportunity to add extra bits on the outside or have it open in response to a specific sequence of DNA and things like that.
Phil Broadwith. You might not have heard of a biosimilar, but that's how the industry is badging the generic forms of some of the more complicated and exotic protein-based drugs that have dominated the therapeutic scene in recent years. But are these biosimilars safe? In fact, how similar actually are they to the drug they're designed to mimic?
I'm Professor Pauline Rudd, so I'm the Nybert Professor of Glycobiology at University College Dublin, and part of my group is doing fundamental research. The other part of my group works with the pharmaceutical companies to try to analyse and control glycosylation on biological drugs.
Thanks, Pauline. First of all, can you tell us, in the old days, when we made a drug, what happened as soon as that drug went off its patent?
Well, these were usually small molecules, which could be chemically synthesised and chemically defined. So it was reasonable for other companies to be able to copy the drug absolutely and know that they had an identical chemical structure. And the issue now is that the new drugs are proteins, which are huge molecules, which have their own particular folding characteristics, their own particular modifications, which are very complex. And so for a company to copy the innovator's drug exactly is really well nigh impossible, I would say. It's hugely more complex than it used to be.
And what could be the clinical impacts of that then?
Well, it depends, of course, what the differences are. So one important area of research is to define what we call critical features of the drug. So what are the critical characteristics of the drug that would make it either unsafe or toxic or not efficacious anymore? For example, in monoclonal antibodies, we have specific features of glycosylation that make the drug unsafe. For example, if it has something that's come from an animal cell which is antigenic to humans, then that would make the drug unsafe. If it had incorrect glycosylation, that would mean that it couldn't enter the effector pathway that you want it to enter, then the drug wouldn't work. So we try to look at each molecule and understand which features are really critical for the safety and efficacy of the drug.
Now, I suppose the pharmaceutical company must actually quite like that in the sense that their agent is hard to copy, because in the old days, they had to make all their money when they had the patent in place, and then as soon as the generics came along, the price plummeted 20-30% off for the same agent. Now, if you've got something where it's really difficult to copy it, the lifetime of that drug therefore must go well beyond potentially the lifetime of the patent.
You're right, it's an advantage to be the innovator because they're not going to give their process information to somebody making a biosimilar. I mean, there are even cases where the biosimilar company makes a drug that has higher activity, and that won't do either because its activity has to be exactly the same as the parent product. So it's a very complex area for drug regulators.
Where does the law stand on this? Do they need to do a complete set of clinical trials on the generics? Presumably not, because they can inherit some of the proof of concept from those. So what does the law say they have to do if you come up with a biosimilar?
It's not exactly a law. It's the regulators who license the drugs to be used in people. It's a judgment for them to decide whether the new product is sufficiently different from the old one that it requires a new clinical trial.
The world is not just one marketplace. We've got different sets of regulations, different sets of rules and regulatory bodies in different countries. Many companies do have a presence in many countries. So what's actually happening geographically? Is there a consensus of opinion as to how to handle this?
Well, the regulators talk to each other, of course. I mean, in fact, the EMA, which is the European Regulatory Authority, have licensed quite a number of biosimilars now. I think the FDA at this moment have not licensed any. So there is a difference. I've just been at the FDA, actually, and there's such a huge responsibility here because if they make a judgment which is wrong and then there are lots of unforeseen side effects, then, of course, they would feel really culpable. So I can see why they would err on the side of caution.
But human life doesn't have a different value depending upon whether you're on one side of the Atlantic or the other. Do you think they're right or wrong?
The EMA are not. They're also extremely cautious. They're not letting out drugs which they think are unsafe, just that they perhaps have made their minds up about the criteria rather earlier than the FDA, that's all. For example, there was a drug called Myozyme, and when the manufacturers scaled up the production, the glycosylation changed. And when they presented these data to the authorities, the two authorities came to a different decision about whether they should have a new clinical trial or not. This actually brought into focus, I think, the need for there to be some more experimentation and some common understanding between the different regulators about what criteria should be monitored.
And probably also some common sense, because, I mean, I was rather shocked the other day. I was talking to a pharmacologist who actually answered the question for me, well, if aspirin were invented today,
it wouldn't be
would we end up giving it to patients and saving the millions of lives that it has? And this person turned around and said to me, absolutely not. Aspirin would never come within a million years of getting near a patient these days.
No, and that's the question, because, you know, you can go on asking companies to do more and more analysis and more functional tests, and then the drugs will be so expensive that nobody will be able to afford them. But I think, you know, one thing that is quite rather more worrying, because drugs that go through regulators they're as safe as human beings can make them safe if the regulators agree that they should be sold. I mean, what's much more important is countries where there's very little regulation or there are a lot of drugs being made illegally. Because, for example, we did some work for the World Anti-Doping Agency. There are many, many types of erythropoietin that are being used illegally and perhaps being sold to patients illegally, which are not efficacious. So they have the wrong sugars attached to the erythropoietin, and so they're cleared in 3 minutes from the patient, where they should stay within the patient for 3 hours. So they actually don't have time to upregulate the pathway which gives you more red blood cells. If you're a patient and you get some of this material over the internet and it's not properly analysed, or it's been analysed and known to be a faulty glycosylation, but they're selling it anyway, then, you know, you risk taking a drug which not only won't do you any good, but it might actually do you harm, because you might raise antibodies against that, and then you would lose not only the EPO that you were taking, but the EPO that you were making yourself. So I think, you know, the non-regulation of these things is something much more to worry about than the great work that's being done by the regulators in Europe and in the US.
Professor Pauline Rudd from University College Dublin. And now to a girl's best friend, diamonds. Although you'd need to be a very tiny girl or perhaps a female nano diamond specialist to appreciate these ones, Patrick.
Yeah, this is Peter Balzowski at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. What they did was they compressed an amorphous carbon aerogel. So amorphous carbon is the non-crystalline form, the kind of thing you put on your barbecue, charcoal, that kind of thing. And then when they compressed it at high pressures, they were able to turn it into a nano-diamond aerogel.
But if you've got something which has got a lot of space and you put it under enormous pressure, doesn't all the space just crush down to make the diamond?
Right, well, in this case, what they did when they crushed it in a diamond anvil, so they're using diamonds to make diamonds in this case, was they deposited the amorphous carbon aerogel, then they poured in supercritical neon, and the supercritical neon supports the structure. So when the crushing is taking place at 20 gigapascals, this stops the whole structure collapsing. I mean, 20 gigapascals is a huge amount of pressure. It's equivalent to 200,000 times our own Earth's atmosphere.
Certainly a tremendous amount of pressure. And when you apply that, what do you get? What happens?
So out the other end, you get a nano-diamond aerogel. So this is an aerogel where the carbon has been compressed so much that it's turned into diamonds, but you can still only get a very small amount of material at the moment. You're talking micron-sized pieces.
And what do we think we could do with them, and why are they important?
So the researchers suggest various possible uses. So these kind of aerogels would have excellent strength. They would also have excellent thermal insulation, and they could also be used as anti-reflection coatings for things like glasses because they have a tunable refraction index.
Are they economically viable to make? Because 20 gigapascals and so on is not trivial. So can we make these on an industrial scale and therefore use them for the kinds of applications you're suggesting, insulation and so on?
Right, at the moment this is a proof of concept trial, but the researchers are looking into ways to produce it more economically. So what they're aiming for now is just to produce it as fast as possible. So they were putting it under huge amounts of pressure. They weren't trying to work out what kind of lower pressures could work.
Certainly an interesting material and one to keep our eye on. Now, you better be careful, Eleanor. You're going to talk about insecticides and the humble honeybee.
Yes. Well, we have heard a lot in the news about the bee population being in decline, and this has an effect on plant pollination, and in turn this affects yields from crops. So scientists are trying to find out why, and they've studied the role of pesticides, habitat loss and disease. Now, one theory is that insecticides are passed to bees in pollen, but there's a new theory. It's put forward by Andrea Tapparo at the University of Padua in Italy. Now, he suggests that bees may pick up a lethal dose of insecticide by grazing on sap produced by crop plants that's present on the leaves.
So where does the insecticide come from in those crop plants?
Well, these are neonicotinoid insecticides that are used to coat the seeds before the plants are planted. And it's thought that the insecticides work their way up the plant through water and end up on the leaves in the water droplets.
Has he got evidence that that's the case, that's really happening?
Well, they've used HPLC, high-performance liquid chromatography, to study the content of the sap on the plant. And yes, they have seen high levels of neonicotinoid insecticides on the leaves.
Devil's advocate here. Farmers have been putting insecticide on plants for a long time with foliar application. They put it straight onto the leaves. So if it was going to be a case of bees drinking stuff off of leaves that might be contaminated, is this not likely already to have been the case and still therefore doesn't explain this very abrupt and sudden decline in bee populations that we're seeing?
Yes, that's true. It's just one theory. I mean, Tapparo himself doesn't think the mechanism they identify is the primary cause. He says that bee decline could be down to many different factors, but he says that it can't be ignored. The insecticides are in these droplets.
It's also interesting that the amount of what they're calling CCD, colony collapse disorder, is actually relatively rare in some places and relatively common in others, but the agricultural practices are quite common to both, which suggests that it may not just be hinging on one thing. And some bee experts I've spoken with have certainly expressed doubt that it's just one cause, and they think that actually it could be a combination of sort of killer factors, such as feeding bees on a monotonous diet of sugary water and stealing all of the honey that they would normally eat themselves and feeding it to humans, of course. So, I mean, this may be one thing, one contributor, but certainly maybe not the whole cause.
No. Tapparo has said that he thinks that biologists and people in the field that are studying the bee decline, it's not always possible for them to have access to the mass spectrometry instrumentation. So he's advocating the use of HPLC as an easier way to detect these compounds in the water on the leaves. So it's a simple procedure, really, that he's recommending.
Is it adequately sensitive then to do that with?
It seems to be, yeah. Yeah, the results they've had do say that there's large concentrations of these insecticides in the sap, and they say that they're high enough to kill bees within a few minutes.
You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, a superior cigarette filter and a new catalyst to get more energy out of waste wood. First, though, time to open your mind. Joan Abbott from King's College works on why we need a blood-brain barrier.
Yes, the whole point is that nerve cells require a much more regulated environment than almost every other cell in the body, particularly because they work on a combination of electrochemistry and chemistry. So the fine membranes that form the nerve cell conduct electricity through ion movement through small channels. And that whole process ionic movement through membranes is what sets up the electrical activity of the brain. And that whole process requires the fluid environment of the brain to be very stable. Otherwise, you get all sorts of extraneous electrical activity and chemical activity, which would disturb the signaling. So the whole point about the blood-brain barrier is to keep this brain environment very regulated and very stable. And then the nervous activity can work in a very reproducible and reliable way to give you, for example, very precise vision, motor control, all the things that our brains do.
On the one hand, that's great for the reasons you've outlined, but then when something goes wrong in the nervous system and you want to get a drug in there, then if you have this impenetrable barrier or near impenetrable barrier or selectively penetrable barrier like the blood-brain barrier is, then you've got a problem.
Yes, well, I think one certainly mustn't get the impression that it's an impenetrable barrier. It does allow through relatively easily things that are soluble in lipids. So, for example, the obvious one is alcohol. Ethanol gets in easily. So, of course, many drugs that have been produced over the years have made use of this. You could make things like barbiturates, which are used for anesthetic, get into the brain because the membranes allow the barbiturates to diffuse through. So that's fairly straightforward. But there are other things that, for example, more recently we could make very complex molecules which could be useful in the brain, things like antibodies, which we know would be very useful if we could get them to the right target. But the big problem then is that the blood-brain barrier is almost certain to impose some kind of restraint on getting these things in. And that's part of its natural function. It actually doesn't want these large peptides and proteins and complex molecules in the brain. A lot of these things could have damaging effects on normal activity.
In some cases, the molecules have a helping hand because there are naturally transporters there that will ship things into the brain, and so some drugs can pretend to be one of the things the brain wants to import across the blood-brain barrier, and they get in that way. I suppose that's quite a good strategy.
You'd have thought it would be a very useful one, and there are lots of these different transporters for all sorts of molecules that the brain does need, and a whole range of other transporters that get rid of waste products in the same sort of way. So, and you might say, okay, well, if we want to get a drug in, why don't we make it piggyback on one of these natural transporters? The obvious example is, yes, it does work. Things like L-DOPA, which have been used to treat Parkinson's quite successfully, use that principle. The L-DOPA goes in on what's called the L-amino acid carrier. But that route has turned out not to be quite as successful as one might guess, particularly because a lot of these transporters are very specific. They will only handle molecules which have a very good fit with the natural agents that are transported. So it's turned out to be somewhat disappointing for example, drug companies who thought this might be a way to re-engineer things to use transporters. And also it's quite hard to make sure that things like the doses are right, because it's harder to predict how much will get transported on the carrier than would be moving by a simple diffusion, for example.
You mentioned drug companies. So what is the drug pipeline actually looking like in this domain?
Well, I think many pharmaceutical companies are having the same problem, that pipelines are looking not very encouraging. There have been some disappointments. So, for example, you might say, well, stroke is a major problem. We should by now have found drugs that would be able to improve the condition in stroke. But that whole area has been quite disappointing, and many companies have given up on the stroke field because it's proved really quite hard to come up with something that's really useful.
So what sort of strategies are people trying, the adventurous ones that haven't given up? What are they doing?
I suppose two approaches. One is to try and reduce the symptoms as much as possible, and that's pretty effective for things like multiple sclerosis and areas where you can damp down the disease. The other is to begin to try and move the whole recognition of the disease much earlier. So you look for very early signs of a dysfunction and you try and treat very early on before too much damage has been done. And that may be the way to go, that companies are beginning to put in a lot more effort into early diagnostics. They're looking for biomarkers of disease, and that may give them a much better chance of treating, because they're going in early when you haven't lost too much brain material and neurons. But then I suppose the reality is that there are still some very difficult diseases like brain tumours. And I think that may turn out to be a more encouraging field because, yes, people are beginning to find quite active agents that will very specifically kill particular types of tumor cell. You just need to get them into the brain. And that's where a more intelligent approach is being used, trying to use as many of the different natural mechanisms for delivery into the brain as possible, and to shape the drug so that not only does it hit the target, the cell you want to kill in the brain, but also it can be got in some subtle way, which may use an endogenous process. And I think the encouraging thing that many of us see is that things like nanomaterials, all sorts of particles that can be artificially made, can be engineered with lots of properties that would make them rather good at this kind of thing. They would be almost like stealth agents. So where many companies are withdrawing from small drugs and simple drugs, they are beginning to show a lot more interest in drugs that are based on biological molecules, much bigger ones, and also these constructs, which are polymers or sort of vesicles, packaging drugs, nanotubes or nanoparticles, and that may be the next generation, which has lots of opportunities.
Joan Abbott. And now, Phil, to a drug that certainly has no problem getting into the brain, nicotine, and we all know where that comes from.
Yes, Chris. Well, what we're talking about here is the filters on the end of the cigarettes. And the aim of those is to capture some of the chemicals that are produced as the tobacco burns sort of the tar and the more carcinogenic components of the smoke to try and stop those getting into smokers' lungs.
So what's the new breakthrough?
Mingdeng Wei at Fuzhou University in China has come up with a material based on titanium dioxide arranged into either nanoscale sheets or tubes that he can make a new kind of filter out of that will absorb more of these toxic compounds.
Absorb, or does it actually deactivate them chemically?
Well, Chris, as well as having a high surface area to absorb these chemicals, it's also got a very acidic surface. So it can deactivate them and break them down, which allows it to absorb even more as the cigarette's smoked.
Have they actually tried this on real cigarettes, or have they just passed smoke or various chemicals through and shown that it can scavenge them and deactivate them? Have they actually got evidence that this, when attached to a cigarette, is going to work?
Well, yes. What they did is make some cigarettes using these filters and then smoke them in a machine, which is a fairly standard way of testing these kind of things. And after they had machine-smoked these things, they looked at concentrations of things like ammonia, hydroquinone, catechol and phenol and several other compounds that are found in cigarette smoke that are known to be toxic or carcinogenic or harmful to our bodies.
And obviously the number one question is there evidence doing a head-to-head trial that if I use this new filter technique composition compared with what we've got at the moment, the next best or the gold standard for the moment, that actually the new composition is better? It does scavenge out more chemicals than the best available filter.
Okay, Chris. Well, the paper doesn't actually include any results for a direct head-to-head against a standard cigarette filter, but those filters...
Or butt-to-butt even, maybe.
Indeed. But those normal filters are made from cellulose acetate, which has a very different surface structure. It doesn't have the acidic sites, so all it can do is physically absorb chemicals, and it'll have quite a different absorption profile as well.
Well, the thing that's worrying me is if it's got that built-in chemistry, is there any chance it could turn something previously innocuous or of low-level toxicity into something a bit nastier?
That's entirely possible, Chris, and it's not something that's covered in the paper, but I'm sure that the researchers will be looking out for that kind of thing as well. They're doing very thorough analysis of the condensate, the smoke that gets through the filter, to characterise exactly what's in there. I mean, obviously, they're looking for specific things that are known, but anything else that comes through that is unidentified would obviously be flagged up as a problem as well. So I'm sure they're looking at it.
No smoke without fire, Phil. Well, of course you don't smoke, do you? Very bad thing to do, very bad thing to do. Don't smoke, filter or no filter. Now, one thing that you can smoke, not breathing it in, but putting it in your wood stove, is wood, and wood burns because it's got loads of lignin in it. But wouldn't it be nice if we had a much better way of getting the energy out of that? And Patrick, you're saying there's a new catalyst which has come along to make this happen. Tell us about this.
Right, well, everyone's aware of the food versus fuel debate. This is the idea that food crops like corn and maize are turned into ethanol. But the problem with this, of course, is that it takes food out of the mouths of people. So this means that researchers are looking for new ways to get fuels out of biomass. So biomass is things like crop residues, leftovers from forestry, And this also includes fast-growing crops like willow and switchgrass, very woody crops.
And the cores out of sweet corn, for example, the bit down the middle that you can't eat, but yep. is very woody.
All these kind of biomass products can all be dropped straight into a reactor, or at least that's the hope, and then they'll be converted by possibly enzymatic or catalytic means into a fuel.
That is already happening, though, to an extent, isn't it? I've seen quite a few papers of people publishing techniques for cellulosic ethanol, for
example. It certainly is,
yeah. So what's different here?
So what's different here is that the researchers have developed a nickel-carbene catalyst that is able to break apart lignin in such a way that it frees up these 9 carbon units that you can find within its structure.
OK, sounds neat, but why is that better than the other techniques that have gone before? What have they produced that's worse than this?
Right, the catalysts in the past had the problem that they're not desperately gentle. They require high temperatures, they require higher pressures. And because of the way they interact with the lignin molecules, they also break it down into various different parts, lots of different lengths, small chain hydrocarbons. So this isn't very useful for turning into fuels. It's not very useful for feedstock chemicals because you've got this mess of all these different components.
It's a very heterogeneous output product.
It is. You want a homogeneous mix.
And that's what this promises, because you'll get these 9 carbon hydrocarbon units, so you could then use that as a feedstock or something.
Yeah. This nickel-carbene catalyst is able to break the C2O linkages between these 9 carbon units that you find in the lignin. If you can free these 9 carbon units, then you can turn them into a useful feedstock chemical, or alternatively, with a bit of processing, a bit of magic and wizardry at the petrochemical kind of stage, you can then blend it up and turn it into a decent fuel that you can put straight into your car.
What sort of numbers are they reporting? Have they actually got any data on how efficient or whether this is scalable, or is this just proof of concept at this stage?
Well, the problem at the moment, they say, is the amount of catalyst required is rather too high, several orders of magnitude too high to be useful on an industrial scale. Another problem with the catalyst, they say, is its sensitivity to water. Obviously, things like biomass, any kind of woody crop, is still going to have a lot of water in it, and that's going to damage the whole process, and you're not going to get the kind of yields that you want to get out of it.
So now it's a question of, having made the intellectual leap, it's a question of optimization, getting the catalyst right to overcome those problems.
They say it's a crime to say that more research is needed at the end of a paper, because more research always is needed. But in this case, they need to take it away and spend a bit more time in the lab optimising it.
Thank you, Patrick. That's almost it for this month, but before we go, you are looking decidedly colourful, Philip.
Well, yes, Chris. Specifically, we're talking about the first colour photograph ever. This is 150 years ago, would you believe?
Quite surprised by that, actually, because I thought that 150 years ago was pretty much not far downstream of Daguerre and daguerreotypes and things, so how was that achieved then?
Well, Chris, it's not a true colour photograph in the sense that we would think of today. It's not a single film capturing all the colours. What James Clerk Maxwell did was take 3 cameras, 3 images, each with a coloured filter on the front. So one red, one green, one blue.
Oh, he cheated.
Well, not exactly cheating. I mean, given the technology at the time, this was pretty high-tech stuff.
So he develops a film, gets something he can project, projects it from 3 different projectors, superimposing all the pictures, and you get a colour rendition of what the cameras saw.
Yes, exactly. So he took a picture of the most colourful thing he could find in the lab, which was a tartan ribbon, and superimposed all 3 pictures to make a beautiful colour projection in the Royal Institution Christmas lecture.
Sounds terrific. So what's the catch?
Well, actually, it turns out it shouldn't have worked, because the film that he was using, the plates that he was using, weren't actually sensitive to red light. So where he had a red filter over the camera should have just turned out black.
So how did he get around that then?
Well, the tartan ribbon that he was photographing, the red parts also reflected UV light as well as red. So that went through the red filter, exposed the film, and when it was reprojected through the red filter, came out red.
Brilliant. OK. So did this then spawn a colour photography revolution, and people were actually doing this to take colour pictures subsequently, or was it just a one-off?
Well, I'm not sure how practical having 3 cameras would be for every picture, but I'm sure some people would have carried on, and it would stimulate people to start looking at other chemicals that would be selectively excited by different wavelengths of light to make colour-sensitive films.
So if you were James Clerk Maxwell in the 1860s, what would you have taken one of the first colour photos of then?
Well, Chris, it would have to be my beautiful wife.
I hope your girlfriend wasn't listening to that, Phil. She'll be most jealous. Well, that's all, folks. Thanks to our contributors this month, Philip Broadwith, Patrick Walter and Eleanor Richards, and our guests, Pauline Rudd and Joan Abbott. The production was by Meera Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientists.com. And until next time, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.